The Synthesis of Yoga, Sri Aurobindo. Part 1, The Yoga of Divine Works, continuing with Chapter 9, Equality and the Annihilation of Ego, starting at the top of page 226. This equality cannot come except by a protracted ordeal and patient self-discipline. So long as desire is strong, equality cannot come at all, except in periods of quiescence and the fatigue of desire. And it is then more likely to be an inert indifference, or desire's recoil from itself, than the true calm and the positive spiritual oneness. Moreover, this discipline or this growth into equality of spirit has its necessary epochs and stages. Ordinarily, we have to begin with a period of endurance, for we must learn to confront, to suffer, and to assimilate all contacts. Each fiber in us must be taught not to wince away from that which pains and repels, and not to run eagerly towards that which pleases and attracts, but rather to accept, to face, to bear, and to conquer. All touches we must be strong to bear, not only those that are proper and personal to us, but those born of our sympathy or our conflict with the worlds around, above or below us, and with their peoples. We shall endure tranquilly the action and impact on us of men and things and forces, the pressure of the gods and the assaults of titans. We shall face and engulf in the unstirred seas of our spirit all that can possibly come to us down the ways of the soul's infinite experience. This is the stoical period of the preparation of equality, its most elementary and yet its heroic age. But this steadfast endurance of the flesh and heart and mind must be reinforced by a sustained sense of spiritual submission to a divine will. This living clay must yield not only with a stern or courageous acquiescence, but with knowledge or with resignation, even in suffering, to the touch of the divine hand that is preparing its perfection. A sage, a devout, or even a tender stoicism of the God-lover is possible. And these are better than the merely pagan, self-reliant endurance which may lend itself to a too great hardening of the vessel of God. For this kind prepares the strength that is capable of wisdom and of love. Its tranquility is a deeply moved calm that passes easily into bliss. The gain of this period of resignation and endurance is the soul's strength equal to all shocks and contacts. There is next a period of high-seated impartiality and indifference in which the soul becomes free from exaltation and depression and escapes from the snare of the eagerness of joy as from the dark net of the pangs of grief and suffering. All things and persons and forces, all thoughts and feelings and sensations and actions, one's own no less than those of others, are regarded from above by a spirit that remains intact and immutable and is not disturbed by these things. This is the philosophic period of the preparation of equality, a wide and august movement. But indifference must not settle into an inert turning away from action and experience. It must not be an aversion born of weariness, disgust, and distaste, a recoil of disappointed or satiated desire, the sullenness of a baffled and dissatisfied egoism forced back from its passionate aims. These recoils come inevitably in the unripe soul and may in some way help the progress by a discouragement of the eager, desire-driven vital nature. But they are not the perfection towards which we labor. The indifference or the impartiality that we must seek after is a calm superiority of the high-seated soul above the context of things. Udasina. It regards and accepts or rejects them, but is not moved in the rejection and is not subjected by the acceptance. It begins to feel itself near, kin to, one with, a silent self and spirit, self-existent, and separate from the workings of nature, which it supports and makes possible, part of or merged in the motionless, calm reality that transcends the motion and action of the universe. The gain of this period of high transcendence is the soul's peace, unrocked and unshaken by the pleasant ripplings or by the tempestuous waves and billows of the world's movement. If we can pass through these two stages of the inner change without being arrested or fixed in either, we are admitted to a greater divine equality, which is capable of a spiritual ardor and tranquil passion of delight, a rapturous, all-understanding and all-possessing equality of the perfected soul, an intense and even wideness and fullness of its being, embracing all things. This is the supreme period, and the passage to it is through the joy of a total self-giving to the divine and to the universal mother. For strength is then crowned by a happy mastery. Peace deepens into bliss. The possession of the divine calm is uplifted and made the ground for the possession of the divine movement. But if this greater perfection is to arrive, the soul's impartial high-seatedness looking down from above on the flux of forms and personalities and movements and forces must be modified and change into a new sense of strong, calm submission and a powerful and intense surrender. This submission will be no longer a resigned acquiescence, but a glad acceptance. For there will be no sense of suffering or of the bearing of a burden or cross. Love and delight and the joy of self-giving will be its brilliant texture. And this surrender will be not only to a divine will, which we perceive and accept and obey, but to a divine wisdom in the will, which we recognize, and a divine love in it, which we feel and rapturously suffer, the wisdom and love of a supreme spirit and self of ourselves and all with which we can achieve a happy and perfect unity. A lonely power, peace and stillness, is the last word of the philosophic equality of the sage. But the soul, in its integral experience, liberates itself from this self-created status and enters into the sea of a supreme and all-embracing ecstasy of the beginningless and endless beatitude of the eternal. Then we are at last capable of receiving all contacts with a blissful equality, because we feel in them the touch of the imperishable love and delight, the happiness absolute that hides ever in the heart of things. The gain of this culmination in a universal and equal rapture is the soul's delight, and the opening gates of the bliss that is infinite, the joy that surpasses all understanding. Before this labor for the annihilation of desire and the conquest of the soul's equality can come to its absolute perfection and fruition, that turn of the spiritual movement must have been completed, which leads to the abolition of the sense of ego. But for the worker, the renunciation of the egoism of action is the most important element in this change. For even when by giving up the fruits and the desires of the fruits to the master of the sacrifice, we have parted with the egoism of rajasic desire, we may still have kept the egoism of the worker. Still, we are subject to the sense that we are ourselves the doer of the act, ourselves its source, and ourselves the giver of the sanction. It is still the I that chooses and determines. It is still the I that undertakes the responsibility and feels the demerit or the merit. An entire removal of this separative ego sense is an essential aim of our yoga. If any ego is to remain in us for a while, it is only a form of it which knows itself to be a form and is ready to disappear as soon as a true center of consciousness is manifested or built in us. That true center is a luminous formulation of the one consciousness and a pure channel and instrument of the one existence. A support for the individual manifestation and action of the universal force, it gradually reveals behind it the true person in us, the central eternal being, an everlasting being of the supreme, a power and portion of the transcendent Shakti. Amsha Sanatana Para Prakriti Jiva Bhuta. Here too, in this movement by which the soul divests itself gradually of the obscure robe of the ego, there is a progress by marked stages. For not only the fruit of works belongs to the Lord alone, but our works also must be His. He is the true Lord of our actions no less than of our result. This we must not see with the thinking mind only. It must become entirely true to our entire consciousness and will. The sadhaka has not only to think and know, but to see and feel concretely and intensely, even in the moment of the working, and in its initiation and whole process, that his works are not his at all, but are coming through him from the supreme existence. He must be always aware of a force, a presence, a will that acts through his individual nature. But there is, in taking this turn, the danger that he may confuse his own disguised or sublimated ego or an inferior power with the Lord, and substitute its demands for the supreme dictates. He may fall into a common ambush of this lower nature and distort his supposed surrender to a higher power into an excuse for a magnified and uncontrolled indulgence of his own self-will and even of his desires and passion. A great sincerity is asked for and has to be imposed not only on the conscious mind, but still more on the subliminal part of us, which is full of hidden movements. For there is there, especially in our subliminal vital nature, an incorrigible charlatan and actor. The sadhaka must first have advanced far in the elimination of desire and in the firm equality of his soul towards all workings and all happenings, before he can utterly lay down the burden of his works on the divine. At every moment, he must proceed with a vigilant eye upon the deceits of the ego and the ambushes of the misleading powers of darkness, whoever represent themselves as the one source of light and truth, and take on them a simulacrum of divine forms in order to capture the soul of the seeker. Immediately, he must take the further step of relegating himself to the position of the witness. Aloof from the prakriti, impersonal and dispassionate, he must watch the executive nature force at work within him and understand its action. He must learn by this separation to recognize the play of her universal forces, and distinguish her interweaving of light and night, the divine and the undivine, and detect her formidable powers and beings that use the ignorant human creature. Nature works in us, says the Gita, through the triple quality of prakriti, the quality of light and good, the quality of passion and desire, and the quality of obscurity and inertia. The seeker must learn to distinguish as an impartial and discerning witness of all that proceeds within this kingdom of his nature, the separate and the combined action of these qualities. He must pursue the workings of the cosmic forces in him through all the labyrinth of their subtle, unseen processes and disguises, and know every intricacy of the maze. As he proceeds in this knowledge, he will be able to become the giver of the sanction and no longer remain an ignorant tool of nature. At first, he must induce the nature force in its action on his instruments to subdue the working of its two lower qualities and bring them into subjection to the quality of light and good. And afterwards, he must persuade that again to offer itself, so that all three may be transformed by a higher power into their divine equivalents, supreme repose and calm, divine illumination and bliss, the eternal divine dynamis, tapas. The first part of this discipline and change can be firmly done, in principle, by the will of the mental being in us. But its full execution and the subsequent transformation can be done only when the deeper psychic soul increases its hold on the nature and replaces the mental being as its ruler. When this happens, he will be ready to make, not only with an aspiration and intention and an initial and progressive self-abandonment, but with the most intense actuality of dynamic self-giving, the complete renunciation of his works to the supreme will. By degrees, his mind of an imperfect human intelligence will be replaced by a spiritual and illumined mind, and that can, in the end, enter into the supramental truth light. He will then no longer act from his nature of the ignorance with its three modes of confused and imperfect activity, but from a diviner nature of spiritual calm, light, power, and bliss. He will act not from an amalgam of an ignorant mind and will, with the drive of a still more ignorant heart of emotion and the desire of the life being and the urge and instinct of the flesh, but first from a spiritualized self and nature, and last from a supermental truth consciousness and its divine force of supernature. Thus are made possible the final steps when the veil of nature is withdrawn, and the seeker is face to face with the master of all existence, and his activities are merged in the action of a supreme energy, which is pure, true, perfect, and blissful forever. Thus, can he utterly renounce to the supramental Shakti his works, as well as the fruits of his works, and act only as the conscious instrument of the eternal worker. No longer giving the sanction, he will rather receive in his instruments and follow in her hands a divine mandate. No longer doing works, he will accept their execution through him by her unsleeping force. No longer willing the fulfillment of his own mental constructions and the satisfaction of his own emotional desires, he will obey and participate in an omnipotent will that is also an omniscient knowledge and a mysterious, magical, and unfathomable love and a vast bottomless sea of the eternal bliss of existence. Thus ends chapter 9, Equality in the Annihilation of Ego.